rejection in a way also frees you from the from needing the acceptance of another person. And I think, I mean, even if we would go to something like a breakup or something like that, like let's say you have a breakup and your whole life crumbles and you feel like your foundation is completely broken and but the only thing you have left is yourself. And I find there's like a beauty in that.
Welcome to Collecting Sparks. I am Sarah Schill, and I'm meeting with people who send out sparks with what they do or who they are. Collecting those sparks is my deep passion, and I hope our conversations will send out sparks to you too, so that they can continue to fly. My guest today is Sophia Hembeck. Sophia is a German-born writer, visual artist, and publisher now located in Edinburgh, Scotland. She studied playwright at the University of Arts in Berlin and also performance art and scenic writing. Sophia worked as a successful theater director, created graphic novels and a podcast that was taken on by Audible. With her own publishing house, Muse Letter Publishing, she released her two poetic memoirs, Things I Have Noticed and Things I Have Loved, and is currently working on the third book to complete the trilogy. Her newsletter, The Muse Letter, became a Substack bestseller in 2023. She also offers essay writing classes both in German and English. I found Sophia through social media and subscribed to her excellent newsletter for some time now. What struck me most is how Sophia took her writing career in her own hands. She didn't wait for some publisher to allow her to become visible, but gave herself the permission to share her art with the world. Her unapologetic self-empowerment is a great example for others to do the same. We talk about leaving our home country and what it means to build your career from the scratch as an artist. Sophia explains how her now impressive success was a step-by-step process and a slow one too. We discuss rejection letters, breakups and tarot reading. Sophia gives ideas on how to start validating yourself and how outside validation might come later. She describes her weekly routines, gives insight on her book writing process and explains why writing the truth comes before all other tools. And we talk about money and why it matters to have a financial foundation, especially for creatives. I loved how open and honest Sophia talks about her career and what it also means to choose this kind of path. I hope our conversation inspires you as much as me. Have a great time with Sophia Hembeck on Collecting Sparks.
I thought I'll go there for 4 months, subletting my flat in Berlin. So worst case, I'll just come back. Like, I felt that 4 months was enough time to sort of figure out whether I'll like it or not. So basically when I left, I told everyone that I would come back, secretly knowing that I wouldn't, but just to kind of to give myself a chance to actually experience it and not, not paint myself into a corner and then be like, oh, actually need to make a U-turn. But I think it was the third week, and I remember standing on the beach talking to my dad, being like, I'm not coming back. Like, it was after 3 weeks I knew this is a good decision. So it was a big step. And now I do want to say, especially as an artist or for someone who is like freelancing or self-employed, and it was a total, I mean, in a way, if you think about it, now I've come out on the other side. So I can be like, well, it all worked out, didn't it? However, if you had talked to me 2 years ago or 3 years ago, before I launched newsletter publishing, before I sort of created this, my own business again and started to be self-employed again. At that time, it felt like a really terrible decision because in a way I hadn't burned any bridges in Germany, but I had no access to those jobs any longer because they were all based in Berlin and I couldn't do any of them remotely. So I was in the UK. I mean, my English is great, or like it's good enough to work here, but I had no connections. I had no support system. I had none of the things that I had in Berlin, like that I had worked for, when I tell someone in Germany, oh, I studied at the University of Arts, this is the course that I did, people in the theater scene, they know. they know exactly what I'm talking about, and they're like, oh, she's a good writer because she studied there, and it's this prestigious thing. In the UK, no one gives a shit because they don't know, or like they don't. It's you're a foreigner, you're not native. It's
especially as a writer, this is where we also started out, no? To say like you're a German writer,
mm-hmm.
and it's not your mother language. So I imagine that must be pretty hard.
It was really hard, and I probably was a bit delusional, to be fair. Like, I definitely did not anticipate what it would mean to... I had to start from scratch. That's that's really what I did. And
this was also 2019, no?
That was 2019.
That means if you started from scratch and went directly into a pandemic also...
So I moved here in May 2019, so I had about 9 months of not knowing what was going to happen. I was kind of lucky because, so after a couple of months, I took a part-time job in a cafe that was also connected to a theatre here. And so just to sort of give myself some... freedom to explore, but also have a bit of security, because I had some savings from my work in Berlin, but it was running out, and I was like, okay, I need to figure this out now. So I took this part-time job whilst kind of figuring out how I could be a freelance writer, or basically continue my career as like maybe a director, do something for the BBC here, all of these things. And I slowly realized that that wasn't going to happen because I didn't have the credentials. I didn't have an internship or something in the UK. And that's also something that was, I didn't know that, but the UK is, they work on references. So if you don't have somebody to refer you, because all my references were in Germany, so all my old employers, they're German. So to the people in the UK, I think they must have looked at my CV and been like, well, that's a bit dodgy, or maybe not dodgy, but it's too much effort to figure out whether she's, you know, not lying, or whether what this actually means. They don't know what Funk is, you know, like they don't know that Auf Klo, which is like a German YouTube, like a feminist queer YouTube show. They don't know how big it is. They can watch the video, but they don't actually understand the content. Like there's so many obstacles. So it was really hard, is the bottom line.
and it's also what many artists feel in their daily life anyways, and this is even topped, but this self-validation, no, to say like I'm an artist and I'm worthy and I'm valid in my work, even if everybody outside is looking at me like I don't know who you are and what you're doing and if this is worth anything.
I believe in self-validation in terms of that, like the only way you can do anything is because you tell yourself that you are able to do it. But I also believe that it's not coming from nowhere. So I think the reason why I could do all of this was also because I've built a steady career, and it was very slow. I just spoke to a friend and I was like, I'm such a slow burn person, because I started writing, that I published something or that I sort of let other people know what I do, when I was like 15, and I wrote my first play with 17. When I was 15, I was working for the newspaper. I did like a freelancer for the local newspaper. That's sort of how I started. And then I wrote a play with 17, and I slowly worked myself up to now to have the confidence that I have now. But it was It's a very, 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 very long process of continuing to you try something out, and then it works, and then you have some proof, and you can like, mm-hmm. validate yourself. And then sometimes something fails and you're like, okay. And you, I think in the end, it's also more about just really wanting it and not letting the fear of failure sort of make you crumble.
Lately, I read the book from Stephen King, where he describes how he stacked his rejection letters on a hook above his bed. And then he added another hook because there were so many. And to continue to do it and to also have your daily practice to be consistent and to stay on track, it's, I think it's a lot of wanting it, but... Yeah, what is it in people that they don't stop, that they don't say like, yeah, okay, I might just not have it, because if all the publishers rejected me, all the agents or whatever, how do you feel that for you?
It's such an interesting question, because I feel like I would answer this question differently anytime you'd ask me, because it's so... I mean, I've been rejected so many times. I mean, I can also stack rejection letters. And
yeah, me too.
I think that's what I meant earlier when I said that I was a bit delusional when I came here, because I expected things to go a lot easier, like a lot easier than it actually did. So I've got so many rejections, and in jobs that I was so sure that I'd be completely suitable for, like that... I was like, why are they not hiring me? Like, how dare they? Like, because I, at that time, had been working in the media, and I felt like I had earned my dues, and like I had paid my dues and had earned something. But so I started from scratch again, and it was really, really hard. And I think there's maybe two things. First of all, you come to a point where you just feel like you don't have any other options. Like, this is your option. Like, I'm 34 now. I'm not going to start studying law now, or I'm not going to change careers now just because it's not working at the moment, just because I got rejected this time. But then you could say, I could have given up earlier, right? So why didn't I give up when... I was rejected actually the first time from that course I was just talking about. So when I was 21, I had applied and they rejected me. And that letter, to be honest, is terrible to receive, because also the way they phrase it in that letter, I mean, I don't know if they changed it now, but I actually also wrote about that in my first memoir, because it was such a terrible moment. You receive the letter and they basically tell you that you don't have talent. They denounce your talent. It's like a line that says, no literary talent detected, or something like that.
What?
Like, there's no...
Oh my God.
Like, you're not a writer. Like, not like... We're sorry, this didn't work out. There's so many other applicants. We have to say no to 495 people because only 5 people get in, or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's brutal. And I think also quite unnecessarily brutal, but I got that letter and I read it and I cried and I sobbed, and it felt like they ripped my heart out and my whole identity crumbled for the day, to be fair, for a day. And... eventually you just, well, at least not just, but I just felt like, well, I'm still gonna do it. I don't care what,
because you wanted it so much.
I wanted it so much, and I knew that I could do it. And I think that's a thing that a lot of people, and maybe this is where delusion is kind of a good thing. You get this fantasy that tells you, well, one day I'm going to win this mega prize and I'm going to take out that rejection letter and I'm going to let everyone know that they were wrong. So you have this feeling of, I want to prove them wrong. And that gives you fire, because you're like, well, a lot of people have been rejected in their lives. A lot of artists, we all know these big stories. of like bestsellers being rejected by publishers, and then after the 10th rejection, they finally got a publisher, and then it was this bestseller. Like, there's so many stories like that. So I think that's what you cling to. and then you continue because you want it, and you believe in yourself enough. But
is it also something that is, yeah, like characteristic of you, something you brought with yourself? I mean, you were 16, I think, when you moved to Thailand for a year. And one side could be like the delusion of just being what people might call a bit naive in like, yeah, I just do it. But then to stay there and to continue and to not say like, oh my God, it's completely different than I thought, or it's much harder than I thought, but I do it anyway. I received this letter that tells me I can't do anything, but I do it anyway. Is this something you came with?
Yeah, I do think there's this strength that I've always had when sort of everything is crumbling around me. I suddenly find this deep sense of security within myself, which, I mean, now I'm kind of like analyzing myself, but I think it's a point of no return. You've got nothing left to lose, so you might as well do it. Like, you, rejection in a way also frees you from needing the acceptance of another person. And I think, I mean, even if we would go to something like a breakup or something like that, like let's say you have a breakup and your whole life crumbles and you feel like your foundation is completely broken, and but the only thing you have left is yourself. And I find there's like a beauty in that, knowing that, but you are still here, and maybe that is all that matters anyway. It kind of makes you actually really clear and focused, because I think as long as you're still trying to get validation from the outside world, you always will be like very needy to get it. But when that outside world says no, it doesn't also matter any longer. You know what I mean? It's like, well, if I'm never going to get that validation, well, then I'm not going to try getting that validation. I'm just going to validate myself. You know, they sort of fade into the background because they're not. Yeah, I think once I know that someone isn't caring about me, it's easy for me not to care about them. I think when I still think that someone is caring about me, I find it hard to cut the connection and to sort of move on. But once I know someone rejected me, I'm like, okay, well, then.
Yeah, I find it also, I had once this one project, and there was really this feeling of, if this doesn't happen, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to die. And then you come out on the other side and you feel like, oh, I'm still alive. So maybe it wasn't a thing. So it wasn't this validation that you are speaking of that really makes me who I am, because without it, I'm still me and I'm still valid as me. So it's really also an experience that can be quite powerful.
Yeah, I totally believe that. I think that there is beauty in sort of your life falling apart. Obviously not in that moment. That's not how you see it. In that moment, it feels shit and you hate everyone. And it's terrible. So I do tarot a lot, and I wrote about it a lot as well. One of my favorite cards is the Tower. So the Tower is basically this card that represents destruction, the downfall of something, the crumbling, the rock being pulled from under you. It's a card that, if you choose it or if you pick it, it feels like a bad omen. You're like, oh no, something is going to happen. But I feel like one of the descriptions I once read was, the Tower is not a place you want to live in anyway. And that's always what I think about when things crumble and fall apart. That's not a place I want to live in anyway. Like, that's a good thing. That's ending or that that's not happening for me. I'm speaking about like rejection and like bad breakups here. Not obviously everything that like some things that end are actually really sad and you grieve. And, but I'm talking about this kind of, like rejection from a job or rejection from a partner. I feel like these things, they end for a reason and it is good that they end. And yeah, you don't want to live in the tower. You don't want to be in a, in an ugly ass tower. You want to leave the tower. It's good when it crumbles. So.
Mm-hmm. But still, I find it very extraordinary. You said you're a slow burner, but looking back at the last 3-4 years of your life, it's always in hindsight, it looks way more straightforward and clear maybe than it was. But being there in this new country with a different language as a writer, as you just described, and then saying, yeah, okay, I'm gonna not only write a book and publish it via Amazon or so, but I'm gonna found a publishing house, I'm gonna write and publish 2 books, I'm doing a weekly column that is highly successful, becomes a Substack bestseller. Also, you also created your calendars, you're giving writing classes. It looks like, wow, so much you created in such little time, and it's so self-empowered and like really, as you described, just if they reject me, I'm doing it anyways. And it looks quite badass to say, looking at what you did and what you're doing.
I mean, I have to say, I feel like you're literally talking to me in like the best time of my life so far. It's like the last 2 years, I would say, that's when all of these things really started coming together. And there was a lot of legwork and a lot of warm up and a lot of trial and error before that people didn't see or weren't necessarily paying attention to. So I know that 2024, like this year, is the year where I'm reaping so much of the things that I've sown in the past. So it's nice to... Well, first of all, thank you for saying that, because I do feel similarly now. When I messaged you and you were like, okay, can you give me a rundown of your life? And I wrote it down and I'm like, it looks pretty impressive. I feel good about this. I feel good about the way that it looks now. I would still have to say a disclaimer. I did not feel this way 3 years ago about it, or even 2 years ago. And only in the last year, I feel like I really, like I took another leap. And I can also feel that another sort of quantum leap is coming. I don't want to spoil anything, but things are aligning. They seem to be aligning, so that's good. But yeah, I think it looks straightforward now, but it wasn't. I mean, I feel like I started over many, many times in my life. As I said, when I got rejected the first time, I studied in Hildesheim for a year, which is this like small city in Germany. And I studied a course that I wasn't interested in really at all. It was like performance art. It was interesting. It was like in my field of interest, but it wasn't actually what I wanted to do. So I've always had years where I was sort of dabbling and kind of grounding and kind of figuring things out. And then I had years where things would flourish. Or like, even when I started studying in Berlin, the first 2 years I worked, I mean, I was a cleaner. I worked in the planetarium. I worked as a babysitter. I had no money and was like, the first 2 years were terrible because studying was a lot. And I also had to, I didn't qualify for state funding any longer. So I had to be partially on benefits, and it was dire. It was really, really dire. And I was very miserable for a long time, and like struggling about money so much. It just felt like I could just pay my rent and food, and that was basically it. And but while I was studying and doing that, I also did a podcast, like I started a podcast, and that was like 2014, which was back then, nobody had a podcast. It was totally new, especially in Germany, which is always a bit later than any, or like than America and the UK. But I did this podcast. It was like an interview podcast, kind of like you're doing. But back then it was, that was really, really new and nobody did it in Germany. And it got a bit of a following. And then 1.5 years later of just doing that for free. And I didn't even really know how many people listened to it, because back then it was still on RSS feed and it, there was no Spotify, like all of these things. They weren't there yet, or they weren't, I think, known. Anyway, but it apparently was so big that actually the people of Audible knew of it. And that's how I then got my my podcast. And I'm telling this story because it's like, there's like great things do happen, but there's also a lot of, there's a usually always a period of time where you really just, or where I was really struggling and working for no money, sort of trying to build something. And then after 1-2 years, hopefully, like, then things like pick up the pace again. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's hard. It's not.
Yeah, and it's
like
also good
line
to see and good to hear, because as I said, if you now look at what you did and where you're standing now, you're like, wow, yeah, okay, that makes totally sense. And it looks so easy in a way from the outside, but I'm sure it wasn't at all.
Yeah,
and I think it also means, I'm not saying I will start from scratch again in 3 years and like move to another country, learn the language there and like completely start from zero again. But I think it's something, if you're an artist or like, yeah, if you're a creative person, you usually go through cycles of creating and then not destroying, but like, you know, like you do go through phases where you're blocked or where things don't work out or where you need a break. And then you come back up again. And I think that's sort of part of being an artist, being creative.
Is that something you would tell somebody who is in a place of feeling stuck and like waiting for some outside validation, some like a publisher to choose them? What is it you would tell them from where you're standing now?
I mean, I feel like the most important thing is that you validate yourself. Like, if you are waiting for somebody else to validate you, that will never work. Like, even if you are chosen, like I have been chosen a few times in my life. Like, I have been picked for like a scholarship. I have won a prize. Like, I've been on the lucky side. I've been more on the rejection side, because the thing is, I think everyone actually is you have more rejections than wins, because the reason you have the wins is because you've got rejected so many times. Like, it's not like you always win or you always get rejected, but it's just the more you ask, the more rejections you get, but the higher the chances that you are going to get a win. But I think what I would tell someone is that there's many, many ways to be an artist. And I do think that we all come with certain gifts and talents. We all have certain assets that we can use. And I always think of this like, what's within your reach right now? Mm-hmm. And to actually be aware of it, because oftentimes we can, like, let's say with a book, the only way to be a published author is by getting an agent, then getting a publisher, and then writing that book. That's one way of doing it. But there's so many other routes that you could take. You could start a podcast, for instance, and then be discovered to write a book. Or like, you could try self-publish it. You could also start a Substack and publish like excerpts of that, or like just figure out what's your writing style or what your audience looks like, who are the people that you're actually writing for. I don't know, there's so many different ways of doing mm-hmm. things, and I always liked the approach to kind of make your own fortune. And I think most of the things that I've done, I've done it myself first, and then sort of the established the people who give you validation eventually ended up giving the validation to me. Like, for instance, with the podcast, I've had my own podcast for 1.5 years, and then Audible came to me and was like, would you like to do this podcast with us, and we pay you? And I was like, yes, great. Or same thing now with my books. I'm self-publishing, but without saying too much, but things are changing. So it's like, mm-hmm. I think not to be afraid to do it yourself, to try. I mean, we live in a world where you can have your own show on YouTube. You can build your own sort of audience, your own creative empire. And like, you don't wait for other people to tell you that what you do is good. I'm not saying anything like, oh, don't publish with a traditional publisher, or like agents are evil or anything like that. Like, those people are also there to support you. But if they're rejecting you at the moment, like, don't reject yourself, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, but it also requires quite some different skills, I feel, no? Because like, being a writer, and in this traditional sense, is you write and then people take care of the rest. And what do you, for example, did is writing and then doing the Kickstarter, which means a lot of showing up and being visible. And I think this requires also, yeah, different skills to show up like that.
Yeah, it was scary, to be fair. It was scary to say, I want to write this book. Would you buy it? If yes, please do that now, without actually knowing if I would finish it. But at that point, I already had built trust, because I had written my Substack for over 9 months, I think, or 10 months. So I already had people reading my work, also reading mm-hmm. it in English. And so there was a trust that, the thing is, nothing that I did came out of nowhere. It always was connected to something that I've done previously. And I think people are not mindful of the steps in between. So I didn't just do a Kickstarter coming out of nowhere. I had the Substack where I was writing weekly essays. So mm-hmm. people knew my writing style, and they could trust that they would probably like the whole collection of those. And that's also how I got the idea, because I was doing it and I was like, oh, what if I do a book that is a lot longer than those essays? What if I can write something new that's sort of, that I haven't written online about, but that I'm going to put in the book? And that's how that sort of came to life. So I think maybe it's also to accept that, or to really think, like, no one just publishes a book or just wins a prize, or, you know, these things don't just, those people have started somewhere. The only thing is that's tricky sometimes, we can't see, we can't trace it back. Like, we can't trace back the whole career. Or even if you look on Instagram, when you see a person that has, like, let's say 20,000 followers, and but they started with 1, they started with 100. Sometimes you can go back, and I do like to do that and see what their first post was and how they sort of grew over time. But most of the time we don't get to see that. So that's why it feels like you get success easily, or that it's sort of...
Mm-hmm. It just came out of nowhere.
Just came out of nowhere. Yeah. So, I mean, most of the people that supported my Kickstarter knew me from basically 6-7 years before that, when I started my podcast, and mm-hmm. or even before. Like, it was a long time coming. So I've got 200 people that are like really close fans that have been looking at me or like have been following my career over the last decade. So those are the people that have been with me and have supported me throughout, but that grew very slowly. I'm always surprised. I feel like other people grow a lot quicker, actually. I'm probably the slowest growing Instagram account, for instance, that I know, because the people that I sort of started with, like friends of mine, they're all like over 20, 50, whatever. Not that that was ever really my goal. I think that's also maybe the difference. But, you know, there's this one quote by Kurt Cobain from Nirvana, who said the sweet spot before they actually got famous was like that, just before, like just when they were playing in Seattle and the clubs were full and it was sweaty and they were just on the cusp of actually being known. And I think just before they, I don't even know if they actually signed a record label or anyway, but I always remember this, like there is a sweet spot. And I feel like I've been always just wanting to be in the sweet spot and not actually getting too large. I like,
and now you do.
I feel like that's what I was saying earlier. Feel like 2024, like the next years, I'm ready now. I'm ready for a bigger audience, and or like I think I'm ready to be okay with people not liking what I say. I was never big enough to
be cancelled or so.
I haven't been cancelled, or I have never sort of had like severe online beef with anybody. Or, I mean, I got maybe like a few negative comments here and there, but yeah, nothing really mentionable, nothing that I ever felt like, oh my God. And I've seen over the years many, many people, some of them my friends, who had some backlash.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, and I guess I was always afraid of it, but I think there comes a time when you just can't that sort of restrain you. And I don't know, I just always hope that the people who connect with me do, and the rest just politely looks away. You know? But
Can you share a bit about your routines, like your daily routines or weekly or yearly routines, like how you build this all up? And yeah, also your writing routines as you are now teaching writing essay classes.
So my writing routine, it shifts, but I do try to, when I work on a book, I do try to write every day. And I try to be mindful that not every day is the same. So some days I can do 2-3 hours. Some days it's just 1 hour. I'm a morning person, so I work in the morning mostly. And it's kind of like after lunch, my brain just doesn't function anymore and I just need to rest. But I get a lot of work done in those 4 hours or 5 hours in the morning. So it works for me.
This is also your planning on the essay classes and stuff, or is this really the time for writing and creating the newsletter?
Yeah, that's like creative writing. Everything else that's sort of more like on the business side or like teaching or admin, I do usually do it in the afternoon or on Mondays, because Mondays, I always do my finances on Monday. Mm-hmm. So I call it Finance Monday, and it's the first thing I do on a Monday. I weirdly love doing it because it feels like it's such a manageable task. It's always the same thing every week. I just put everything that I made into a spreadsheet and everything that I paid for, like all my expenses. And then I look at it and then I feel good or bad, or but like I kind of reassure myself that everything's going to be fine. And then I move on. And I don't know, I like doing sort of businessy admin stuff on Mondays. But I also work on the weekend. I try to have a weekend or like 2 days in the week where I'm not working. When you're self-employed, it's like you are always working, and and you're also not working. So it's hard to distinguish the two. I'm trying to work on creating a bit more of a boundary for like actual free time, because often my free time is still me reading something and then writing something down. Or even when I watch something on Netflix, like my, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, I wrote about the show Beef, which is a really good show. And, but I was watching it, but I was also like, I'm going to write about this later. So it's kind of, it's not very separate. So it's just kind of like me going through the day, always working, but also kind of not, if that makes sense. So
yeah, but you try to write on a daily basis, especially when you're writing on a book.
Or when I'm working on a book, I have a strict plan. I have a strict plan, and I am actually currently writing on a book. So what I do is I'll go to, I have a co-working space now, so I go to my co-working space and then I sit there and then I work on the book.
And how do you know that it's done? When do you know that this is finished? Because you don't have somebody, or didn't have till now, somebody to say like, yeah, okay, we're at the right point.
Easily, I would just say you just kind of know. You work on it. Yeah, because I mean, I have a vision of the book, so I know what I'm going to write about. With the first book, I knew that it was going to be three parts. So the book is called Things I've Noticed, Essays on Leaving, Searching, Finding, and the three parts are Leaving, Searching, Finding. So in the first part, in the first section, I write about all the moments when I left a place, or I left someone, or I kind of left myself. So a lot of associations on the word leaving and kind of stories in my life that connect to that. And then the second part was like searching. So it was a lot about who am I and what is life? And then the third part was sort of how I kind of found my home in Edinburgh and kind of found myself. And so it was pretty clear what the book was going to be about and how it would be structured. So I was done when that was accomplished. So that felt really easy. And with the second book, that was a lot more complicated because the structure was not as clear in the beginning, and I actually found the structure while I was writing it. I feel like I always set out to say something with the book. So the second one, I wanted to capture this feeling of self-worth and how it's connected to our decision-making and how to our relationships, and how when you have low self-worth, like you tend to make decisions that are not in your favor. And specifically in like the whole book is about romantic and relationships and friendship and family. So how we relate to another person and how low self-worth is actually, it's really hard to connect with other people when your self-worth is really low. And I kind of wanted to talk about how I went through that process of actually raising my self-worth over time and the reasons why it was low in the first place, which was like my family and childhood background, and then how that sort of transpired in my relationships, and then kind of coming out of it and realizing, wow, I need to raise my self-worth. Otherwise, I'm never going to be like happy, basically, or I'm never going to be able to find love in a nurturing way. So that was the book that I was like, I wanted to write, and I knew I was done when I felt like I've said everything that I knew about that.
And in your writing classes, what would you say is the most important thing that you tell your students?
I really try, because I did study creative writing. I've also been to a lot of creative writing workshops and classes and stuff, and I've met different teachers, some good, some terrible and soul destroying. So like I have a big experience of this is like a really good way of teaching people, and this is like basically not making you want to write ever again. Yeah. So my aim with these classes was to obviously be on the nurturing side and to really be clear that like no one has the right to take away your talent or your creativity and to sort of pronounce that, to say that you're not a writer or you can't do this. Like that, no one is that wise or smart or, you know, like that's not okay. But I feel like there's this discourse that being an artist is like about suffering, or that you need to suffer in order to create good art, and you need to go through a lot of terrible things in your life and have trauma to so that you can create. And I think that's not true at all. I actually believe the only moment when you can actually write is when you are coming out of it and you're actually in a healthier place, and then you can write about it. So people might think, oh, this is like it, you needed all of that shit to happen, but that's not true. Like you're able to write because you're better again now. And I don't know, I feel like what I'm trying to teach is that it's about being playful, it's about being curious about life and yourself. I think the most important part as an artist is to be vulnerable, to be to ask yourself a lot of questions, to be curious, to investigate, and to know yourself, and to allow yourself that you can share that with other people. And I mean, my whole reason I wanted to be a writer was I love that feeling when you read something that makes you just feel like, exactly what I'm thinking, or that's exactly what I've been through, and you were scared to tell anybody, and you read it and you're like, oh, I'm not alone, this is not something to be ashamed of, or this is not something, I'm not the only person who's struggling with it. I loved reading
Samuel Beckett.
I once read his diaries, and he writes a lot about death, and I'm also a big contemplator on death. But anyway, I read this diary and I was like, oh, that's amazing. I feel exactly like that. And I feel like everyone has that. Everyone has something to share.
So this is what you encourage people to do also, to be really honest and vulnerable about how they feel, or...
Yeah, to share their point of view and to be brave. I think that's the starting point, and that's already valuable. And then if we're talking about like, is it art or is it literary or whatever? I feel like that comes second, because it's not really about that, I think. It's nice, and it's great when someone is also able to make it sound good. And I think that's also really important. That's like a skill. I think the first thing is to actually have the guts to speak the truth. Then we can talk about how we can make that sound really great. Like that's like step two. But step one is actually telling the truth. I think that's more important. It's not important though to also make it sound good, but
to start at the nucleus, no?
Yeah, because I feel like also there is some art out there or some writing out there that is just skill, and not there's no truth behind it. There's no gumption or that's just sort of decorum that. Personally, I don't think that's, I wouldn't want to encourage that, I guess. I would encourage people to tell their truth.
If you look back at yourself, like at this point that we started off being in Berlin, wanting to go or planning to go to Edinburgh, what would you tell her from where you stand today?
I would say save some more money because it's going to run out quicker than you think. I think I just say, like, you're doing so well. You're doing so well and you're going to be fine. But also, it's probably going to be a bit harder than you think. But I don't think that would have been a good advice, though, because what I told myself then was that I'm capable and I can do it. And I think that's what I should tell her as well, even though it's not quite the truth.
Okay.
I think I would just say you're doing well and you're gonna be fine and you're capable, but maybe a little bit more money would be good to save up, or to not spend so much on things that aren't actually that important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's actually something people maybe don't talk about enough, is that whether you have a safety blanket, like a financial safety blanket or not, really is, I think it's so important when you're a creative, because it really messes with your mental health when you know that this is the, like, you don't have any money left in your bank account, but like your art is sort of, that's the way you need to make money. Like, it puts a lot of pressure on your art. That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely is hard when you don't have any sort of other income, or, I don't know, parents in the background, or, which I didn't have that. So, I think don't beat yourself up if that's the case and you cannot commit so much to your art practice, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Who do you want to have been, like, the end of your life looking back?
I think I always kind of visualize myself with a big family around me. So I want to be important to like people around me. There is a part of me in the background right now saying, I want to, you know, win the Nobel Prize, and I want all of these like glamorous things. And that is not true. Like, yes, I would love to have like a big literary career, for it to continue but actually, really, I think I want people to feel like she was like a fun, kind, and if I'm older, an elegant lady who is like lovely to be around and gave some good advice and kind of pretty modest, I guess. But there's another part that it does definitely want the fame.
The Nobel Prize.
And the Nobel Prize and, I don't know, some... Yeah, I think, I mean, what I would really want is just like a long-lasting career. I think that's the most precious thing that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to be able to write a book every 3-4 years, to have that be of, you know, like a good... success, doesn't have to be bestseller, but just, you know, like a steady up pace. Maybe when I'm 50, I can win some prizes, and then, you know, like have like a good run, and not just a sprint. But the good thing is I'm too old now for a sprint anyway. I don't fall into the category of like young debut author. I mean, I'm still young. I'm not saying that I'm old now, but I'm not the 21-year-old debut author, or the 25-year-old or something. Like, I think next year I basically cannot run in any of those young novelist categories any longer, because they're only till 35. So, yeah. So I'm already, that's not a problem anymore, I think. Like,
Yeah, so if the sprint is not an option, as you described before, the marathon is the only option.
I'm continuing to run, so...
Okay, last question. The big book of stories, like there's the grand book of stories, and you could add one story to it.
That would like I haven't written that thing yet, I would say. I think that's something that I hopefully will write someday, but I don't think I've written that thing yet, which it feels good. I want it to be far away, not far, far away, but I think it would have been, you probably, maybe you should never feel like you've already done the work. Mm-hmm. Maybe when you're like 80 or 90 and you can be like, yeah, I've done the work. The piece is there.
But this is a nice view. I never had this answer to say like I'm going to write that story, but it's not there yet.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that keeps me going as well. Mm-hmm. I think that there's still something out there that I can contribute, that I can let the world know about, that there's a secret that I can explore and a riddle to solve. So yeah, still out there.
That was Sophia Hembeck on Collecting Sparks. Thank you so much for listening. I love how Sophia took her own career and fortune in her hands and shows others that we don't need to wait around for an outside permission slip. Check out her newsletter that I linked in the show notes, follow her on social media, and support her work. We need more independent, self-validated artists to show us if she can do it, so can I. If you like this episode, please recommend, share, and comment. It would mean a lot. I'll speak to you next time for our new episode of Collecting Sparks. See you then, Sarah.